The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Richard Lee.
The Americans have arrived. But according to The Guardian's fiction editor, Justine Jordan, they weren't the ones we were expecting. Yes, it's the 2014 Booker Prize. Despite widespread predictions of US domination, the judges unveiled a shortlist of six earlier this week with one person of colour, two women, and only two Americans. But no David Mitchell, no Richard Powers, and no Siri Husfeld. With me to discuss the books which are actually on it are the critic Catherine Taylor, the bookseller Jonathan Rupin, and The Guardian's literary editor Claire Marmitstead. Here's the list in alphabetical order. To Rise Again at a Decent Hour by Joshua Ferris. The Narrow Road to the Deep North by Richard Flanagan. We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves by Karen Joy Fowler. Jay by Howard Jacobson. The Lives of Others by Neil Mukherjee. And finally, How to Be Both by Ali Smith. So, first impressions, Claire. Good list or bad list?
I think they've made a very good shortlist out of a not very good long list. And I can see at least three possible winners on this, which is kind of what you want.
Three would do, wouldn't it? And how about you, Catherine? There's no David Mitchell, of course.
No, interesting enough, James Wood wrote in The New Yorker this week that meaning is a bit of a bore, but storytelling is alive. And he was actually reviewing The Bone Clocks by David Mitchell. And, you know, he is the puppet master of the intricate construction. And it's a real a surprise not to see him on this list, actually.
But the remains of the list, are you a thumbs up or thumbs down?
I'm pretty much in agreement with three of the books. And I'm sort of on a kind of wavering point with two of them.
But how about you, Jonathan? There's five out of six from Penguin Random House, I note.
Yes, I think there will be questions raised about that, but I think one has to be very careful about extrapolating something from six books that were chosen on their individual merits. I think it's more indicative of the fact that there's so much published these days that publishers are desperate to get books onto a prize shortlist to get the sales. But the list itself, I think, is a very interesting one. I think there are four possible winners on there, but I think there are two that are very unlikely winners, and they're the Americans. I mean, I think, Richard, you're right to say that if we'd guessed which two Americans from the long list were going to make it, it wouldn't have been these two.
Let's start, anyway, with a reading from the man on the shortlist who's already won the Booker Prize, Howard Jacobson. Jay is something of a departure for Jacobson, a portrait of a world only a step away from our own, as John Burnside described it in The Guardian, where childish adults live in disturbing conformity after some half-acknowledged outbreak of mass violence. Here Jacobson strikes a tender note as Cavan offers his girlfriend Aileen something of a confession.
Cavan thought he'd better prepare Aileen for what she might hear. He had, some months before they'd met, he mustered the honour to tell her, kissed the murdered woman. He knew not to say it was nothing. Women didn't like to hear men say that things they did with their bodies and which ought to involve their emotions were nothing. If it was nothing, then why do it? And if it was something, then don't lie about it. But it wasn't a long kiss, and if he hadn't thought about it much the day after, he wasn't going to claim he hadn't thought about it at all. He certainly hadn't thought about it since he'd been with Aileen, who drove all trace of memory of other kisses from his mind. She was disappointed in him. Not angry, just disappointed. Which was worse. "I'm sorry," he said, "if I've made you jealous." "Jealous? I don't mean jealous." "Then what do you mean?" What did he mean? "You know," he said. "Was there something between you I should be jealous of?" "No, no." Here it came. In that case, why did he bother to kiss her? "What I feel," she said, letting him off, "is that it would have been nice to go on thinking of you as a man who doesn't throw kisses around, who respects himself, or at least his mouth, more." Cavan tried to think of any man he knew who respected his mouth. "Well, it was no disrespect to you," he said. "I hadn't met you. Unless you believe one can demean a person in retrospect." She thought about it for longer than he would have liked. No, no, it doesn't demean me in retrospect, she said at last. It demeans you, which reflects on me, and it takes a little from my fantasy, but that was always just girlish nonsense anyway. So no, yes, I'm all right about it, and I thank you for being honest with me. Caven felt he'd been kicked in the stomach. She was no, yes, knowing him. Yes, no, she was all right about it, which was the language of compromise and disillusionment. And he had shattered her fantasy, which meant her hope to live a life above the common. He had brought her low with his honesty, honesty being the kindest yes, no word she could find for his being a man like every man. He asked her to make love to him on his bed with the sheets thrown back and the windows open, not to remove all trace of Luena Morgenstern's kisses from his lips, but to remove all trace of this conversation. She shook her head. It didn't quite work like that for her. In the open air, then, on the cliffs, in Paradise Valley, let nature do the job. But she wasn't quite in the mood for that either. She would walk with him, though, a long, bracing walk where they could talk about something else. Look beyond them, not talk about themselves at all. We are a bit in each other's heads, she said. He knew what she meant, but the last thing he wanted to do was walk her out of his. They walked well together, he thought, which was a sign of their compatibility. They were always in step. When one put out a hand, the other found it immediately. They stopped to look at the same flowers or to admire the same picturesque cottage. They stopped in unison to stroke a cat or pick up litter. Neither started to speak before the other had quite finished, or at the very moment that the other began a sentence. They talked side by side, like instruments in an orchestra. This wasn't only good manners, it was an instinctive compatibility. Their hearts beat to an identical rhythm. He laughed suddenly for no reason, threw back his head and laughed at the sky. She didn't ask him why, she simply threw back her head and did the same. A minute later, she seized him by the arm and made him look at her. This is very dangerous, she said. You think I don't know that, was his reply.
Howard Jacobson there on the language of compromise and disillusionment. Jay is something of a departure for the British Philip Roth, isn't it, Catherine?
Yes, and I think we actually saw that with his previous Booker winner, The Finkler Question, where he's moving away from, I think, what a lot of people call his sort of rambunctious prose to more satire, but actually with this novel, a very cold, restrained kind of satire. I mean, the jokes are in there, but actually he's dealing with a post-apocalyptic situation with language and the distortion of language, rather like Ben Marcus did with last year's The Flame Alphabet and that sort of the Holocaust. And of course, the interesting point about the novel titled J is that the letter is actually not used in the book at all. And I think it's all about what we have hidden, that people have actually disappeared from society but not spoken about. And there's a lot of that sort of Orwellian doublespeak going on there as well.
So it's a very kind of contemporary dystopia, isn't it? John Burnside compares him to Orwell, as you do, and to Huxley and Zamyatin as well, but notes that he skewers the formulaic kind of pop culture of our contemporary life and also our infantile consumption and also the systemic contempt for privacy.
That's right. And I think he's feeding into society's obsession with the outsider, which is definitely something that's going on at the moment. And, you know, it's quite a useful and interesting framework to use post-apocalypse environment as a narrative point for that.
It's very much of the moment, isn't it? What about Jacobson's trademark humour, Jonathan? He's not playing the apocalypse for laughs here, is he?
No, I got the impression, I mean, we did a little interview with him on the Foyle's website, and I got the impression this was a very deliberate departure for him. I think he felt that the type of humour that he's used so effectively in his previous novels was starting to railroad him a little bit and wasn't giving him the chance to make the commentary about contemporary society that he wanted to. And I think the comparisons with people like Orwell and Huxley and Zamyatin are quite interesting because, of course, we've had so much dystopian fiction in the young adult market recently, and it's made that type of literature into something that's very populist and very dramatic and all about stories of survival. Whereas I think what Howard Jacobson has possibly quite deliberately done is reclaim the dystopia for serious literary fiction.
So those in search of a genuine belly laugh should turn to Joshua Ferris, longlisted for the first book award in 2007, shouldn't they, Claire?
Yes, I know Jonathan is sceptical about Joshua Ferris. And actually, very interestingly, when we longlisted, then we came to the end for the first book prize, the reading groups didn't buy it. I think that it's what I would call water cooler humour. It was a sort of office set thing and felt quite cool and postmodern and American. Very of the zeitgeist. And they didn't like it, whereas we all absolutely loved it. And I suspect that this is going to divide people along similar lines. I personally really enjoy it. I think there's a little bit of Howard Jacobson in it, actually. You've got this dentist who rails about his humanity and tries to find the meaning of life, trying to find God, Jewish.
I think Michael Chabon is possibly the comparison to make in terms of other writers and an American writer who's similar to him. I mean, I've always found Michael Chabon a bit hit and miss, and I think Joshua Ferris doesn't quite come up to Chabon's standard. I mean, I loved And When We Came to the End, but both of those books I wouldn't consider to be quite the sort of book that the Booker Prize would traditionally try and recognise.
But you see, I pick you up on that. Is this what the Booker Prize should be looking for, the sort of book that the Booker Prize traditionally recognises, or should they be going for something completely different?
I certainly think they should be going for innovation, and I think that there is innovation in the shortlist. I mean, if you look at something like the Ali Smith, she does challenge the basic and fundamental way that we tell a story. I don't have a problem with what Joshua Ferris does. I just think it's quite lightweight and quite insubstantial in terms of the themes that it's addressing and the story that he tells as a result.
A couple of the books, including the Ali Smith, a couple of the books on the shortlist have set you thinking about spoilers, haven't they, Claire?
Yes. Now, I read the Karen Joy Fowler on a long-haul flight, and I just picked it up before I left, and I didn't have a press release or anything. It was before it was published. And I read the first 77 pages thinking this was a small girl story about the loss of her sister, and I didn't realise what the point was of it until then. And then when I came back, I was sort of horrified to find that all the reviews were prefaced with pictures of chimps. Can we say this? I mean, actually, we can say this because she herself has talks very openly about how it is a thing about anthropological research and the damage that it has done to...
And I think also that the marketing department of the publisher, had to make a choice really about how they were going to publicise the book. With the fact that the spoiler, if you like, was already out there, they chose to make a feature of it, which you can say is quite an ingenious way of marketing the book.
Was Serpent's Tale in the UK originally intended to try and keep it under wraps more, which is why the hardback cover is very different from the paperback cover. But in the States, where it came out a bit earlier, they made no secret of the twist with the cover design at all. They gave it all away. And I think the feeling was that social networking these days means it's impossible to keep a secret like that.
So go on, for anybody who hasn't yet in on the secret, what is the twist that's being revealed?
The twist is that the younger sister of the girl who narrates turns out to be a chimp who has been brought home to be raised as if she were a human girl.
But you only have to wait till page 77 to find that out.
There you go, 77 is the number to watch out for. Ali Smith is up to something a little bit similar, isn't she? I'm speaking at the Edinburgh Book Festival before publication. She glossed over the novel's structural shenanigans, but the reading she chose offered something of a hint that things aren't going to be entirely straightforward.
It is last May in Italy. George and her mother and Henry are sitting after supper at a table outside a restaurant under some arches near the castle. Her mother has been going on and on to them, well, to George, because Henry is on a computer game about fresco structure, about how when some frescoes in a different Italian city were damaged in the 1960s in bad flooding, and the authorities and restorers removed them to mend them as best they could, they found underneath them the underdrawing their artists had made for them, and sometimes the underdrawings were significantly different from their surfaces, which is something they'd never have discovered if there hadn't been the damage in the first place. George is only half listening because the game Henry is looking at on the iPad is called Injustice, and George thinks Henry is far too young for it. "What game is it?" her mother says. "It's the one where all the cartoon superheroes have turned evil," George says. "It's really violent." "Henry," her mother says. She takes an earphone out of one of Henry's ears. "What?" Henry says. "Find something less violent to do on there," his mother says. "Okay," Henry says, "if I must." "You must," his mother says. Henry puts the earphone back in and clicks off the game. He clicks on a download of Horrible Histories instead. Pretty soon he is giggling to himself. Not long after that, he falls asleep at the table with his head on the iPad. But which came first, her mother says, the chicken or the egg, the picture underneath or the picture on the surface? The picture below came first, George says, because it was done first. But the first thing we see, her mother says, and most times the only thing we see, is the one on the surface. So does that mean it comes first after all? And does that mean the other picture, if we don't know about it, may as well not exist? George sighs heavily. Her mother points across the way to the castle wall. A bus goes past. Its whole back is an advert for something in which there's a Madonna and child picture, as if from the past, except the mother is showing the baby Jesus how to look something up on an iPad. We are sitting here having our supper, her mother's saying, and looking at everything that's round us and over there, right there in front of us. Now, if this was a night 70 years ago... Yeah, but it isn't, George says. It's now. We'd be sitting here watching people being lined up and shot against that wall, along from where those seats for the cafe bar are. Ah, God, George says. Mum, how do you even know that? Would it be better, or worse, or truer, or falser, if I didn't, her mother says. George scowls. History is horrible. It is a mound of bodies pressing down into the ground below cities and towns and the unending wars and the famines and the diseases and all the people starved or done away with or rounded up and shot or tortured and left to die or put up against the walls near castles or stood in front of ditches and shot into them. George is appalled by history, its only redeeming feature being that it tends to be well and truly over. And which comes first, her unbearable mother is saying, what we see or how we see? Yeah, but that thing happening with the shooting, it was eons ago, George says. Only 20 years before me, and here I am sitting here right now, her mother says. Ancient history, George says. And that's me, her mother says. And yet, here I am, still happening.
The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
So, what's the answer to Smith's riddle of a novel, Claire? Which comes first, the chicken or the egg?
Well, for me, the egg came first. But for Catherine, the chicken came first,
yes,
as we would both say. I read the modern bit first.
What's this mysterious construction that we're all dodging around here?
Well, one section is a Renaissance section, and one section is set in the present day. They're sort of intricately related to each other.
It depends really which book you pick up as to which arrangement you read first.
So they're literally different ways round in different books?
That's right.
And is there any way of telling them apart?
Absolutely the same story.
And it's got, interestingly, it's got the same ISBN number, hasn't it, Jonathan?
It has.
So that it is absolutely indistinguishable. And in foils today, there may be all one version or all another version or a mixture. It's completely randomised, isn't it, which one you'll pick
Actually,
up.
Actually, I had the opportunity to go through all our copies just before we came because Ali Smith is dropping by the shop to sign them this afternoon. And yes, there is absolutely no way of telling at all. I have to say, the ISBN situation makes it slightly complicated because you always get the odd customer who wants a specific edition, and particularly if they're ordering, say, on the phone or online, there's no way to differentiate in terms of identifying it by its ISBN, which edition that they're getting. So it does require a bit of human intervention to get the right book to them. Publishers have done this before in terms of making it complicated for us. I mean, when Irvin Welsh's Filth came out, it had four different coloured covers, and everybody wanted the blue one. So it's a slight complication from a technical point of view from bookshops, but in terms of generating interest, it's a fascinating thing to deal with.
And the interesting thing will be whether people will buy two copies. I mean, actually, I would be tempted to.
You have.
And have you read it from both directions?
Well, I've given one to a relative. We were enjoying a different reading experience. I just actually wanted to find out whether it was different for both of us or whether it was seamless because, you know, Smith is such a dazzlingly inventive writer. She, again, you know, every book seems to be a bit of a game changer. And I think this one is real culmination of the skill and the language and the playing around with structure. A lot of people have said, oh, she's too stylistic. And, you know, the story gets buried, but she's a wonderful storyteller as well.
See, I felt that if I'd read the second section as it appeared to me, i.e. the Renaissance section first, I might have had trouble getting into it because her syntax is quite challenging. Her vocabulary is not challenging. She doesn't actually use any sort of these and thous in it.
She opens with a kind of free fall of language. Which is sort of to describe a kind of thought process, really, in the Renaissance section. And then, of course, you get to slightly more conventional, if we can call Ali Smith conventional, structure in the second half of the book, which, of course, might be the first half, depending upon which one you pick up.
But what does this do to the literary conversation when we don't actually wind up reading the same novel?
I think it's wonderful because it really challenges the reader without giving the reader a directive. I mean, I know some reviewers had both copies, perhaps with a little note from the publisher saying this is not a mistake. But, you know, I think we can all bumble along just reading and be very sort of unchallenged by it. And I think, you know, she's constantly, as I said, reinventing and innovative. And I think that's something that the reader would really appreciate.
If we talk about the longer life of books, and Richard made a very interesting point earlier when we were discussing this, most readers will come to it in years in the life of this book, and many of them will just pick it up and read it, and they won't know what they're getting. They won't know that there's an alternative ordering. What do you think the implications of that is?
So you think it's sort of short-termism, really?
Is it? Yeah, is it?
I think it'll be made far more explicit on the paperback, which obviously is an edition that's meant to appeal to a far broader...
Of course, the hint is in the title.
...cross-section of the public. But I think it's very interesting because one of the things that we don't do very much is talk about the books we've read with other people. And the fact that there is issue encourages people to do that, to do it. And it also might encourage people to reread the book. The one advantage that the Booker judges have over the rest of us is that they focus exclusively on contemporary fiction for a year. They read nothing else. They become the best read people in the country for a year. And they read, certainly the ones that they're seriously considering for the shortlist and for the prize, they read several times over and they have intense conversations about what those books are doing. It's far more than whether it's just entertainment, whether it tells a good story. And I think they really start to drill down into the possibilities of the novel, and they possibly appreciate the qualities that the rest of us don't get unless we make the effort to spend time with the book.
There is another plot reveal, isn't there, that reviewers have given away, which is to do with the Renaissance section, to do with the identity of the Renaissance artist.
Again,
we're not going to give it away.
We're
on
not
this
going
podcast.
To give it away, but I mean, let's just give a hint. It's that obviously Ali Smith loves to play with gender stereotypes, and that's something again that's actually quite related to the period of the Renaissance in which she's writing about too. I think it's going to be a delightful uncovering, just as the 100-year-old fresco is as well for readers.
One of the other novels on the list, which has generated something of a buzz in this short-term media-driven conversation that we're having, is Richard Flanagan's The Narrow Road to the Deep North. Thomas Keneally suggested that it was full of bravura accomplishments, which the reader has no time to notice as they are swept along by the tale. Should we believe the hype, Catherine?
Yes, I mean, I think this is a consummately well-written book, and to me it seems to have everything. It's a historical novel. He's talking about the Death Railway, so-called Death Railway, which was built between Thailand and Burma by prisoners of war and local workers under the charge of the Japanese army in 1943. And what he does amazingly well is his narrative changes from this very sort of otherworldly, hallucinatory narrative to very forensic, stomach-churning descriptions of the hell on earth, really, that is the prisoner of war camp. And he really doesn't let up for the course of the novel, which is told in flashback. But also, as you get towards the end and as the main protagonists get older, so, you know, this is a novel that probably encompasses in its last reaches about 50 years, there are continual shocks and surprises and twists of fate. And it is a very much a fatalistic novel. It is a hugely satisfying book, and it's a very complete novel. I think there's pretty much nothing left unfinished in it.
History, war crimes, memory. It's hard to imagine a more bookerable novel, unless, of course, that's Neil Mukherjee's examination of Marxism in 1960s Calcutta, Claire.
Well, this is fascinating to me because the Naxalites make an appearance in this, as they did in last year's shortlist with Jhumpa Lahiri's The Lowland. And this, to me, would be a sort of absolutely vintage Booker winner were it to go on and win. It's a beautifully told, partly realist novel. There are two interleaved strands, one of which is a realist family saga, which Neil Mukherjee will hate to hear me describing it as, the other of which is the journal of this defector of a wealthy paper mill-owning family to the Naxalites and his account of the struggle, as it were.
So if you had to pick a winner, Catherine, who would it be?
It would be, for me, between Flanagan and Smith. Very, very different books. One obviously has, as I said, the more conventional structure, but it's a hugely satisfying read, and the other is just defying every kind of structure you can think of. But again, it has a very profound level to it.
And how about you, Jonathan? If you had to go for one, what's it going to be?
You see, this is quite interesting because I think this could go a number of ways. And the reason I say this is because the shortlist doesn't seem to have a coherence to it. There doesn't seem to be one mind behind it. In the last 2 years, we've had two very strong chairs in Peter Stoddard and Robert McFarlane, who I think have imposed their own vision of what the Booker Prize should stand for and have given us two terrific winners in Hilary Mantel and Eleanor Catton. A.C. Grayling is very well read, but he's possibly not as knowledgeable as some of his other panellists, people like Erica Wagner and Sarah Churchwell. So I think he's possibly got personalities who are pushing in different directions, which is why you've got a shortlist that has books that don't necessarily sit together and seem to exemplify different ideals of what the Booker Prize should stand for. And it's very interesting. I did actually chat with one of the Booker judges at the shortlist party and put this to this particular judge, and the word that I got back to describe the panel was polarised. I still think that the more traditional route is the one they're likely to go down, and I'm afraid I'm just going to agree with Catherine and say it's between Flanagan and Smith. I've been tipping Flanagan, but I'm just beginning to get the impression that the impetus is behind Smith in terms of the passion that it's creating across a huge range of different types of readers. And I think that might just mean in a six-person panel, it might just get the nod.
And how about you, Claire? What would you be plumping for? Another Smith fan?
My heart says Ali Smith. My head says Neil Mukherjee. Yeah, my heart says Ali Smith. I just think this is a bravura novel. And it's just, it isn't just technically dazzling, which, like the Joshua Ferris, it has real heart and soul.
It's an elegy of loss, really, which we haven't discussed yet.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yes. But my head says, Flanagan, I have to say I haven't read, but I think Neil Mukherjee is really in with a chance. If, as Jonathan says, the jury is split and decides to go down the sort of slightly more conventional line, which is absolutely not to say that I think this is not a very fine novel in its own right, but I think it would be quite a conventional Booker winner.
The return of the Naxalites. The Naxalites aren't the only subject which is making a return.
No, this is so interesting. So the Burma Railway featured in Tuan Tan Eng's Garden of Evening Mists. This comes back to the whole history of the Booker, is there are these big post-colonialist themes that keep coming back. You know, if you go right the way back to the siege of Krishnapur, you know, it's part of the heritage of this prize. And it doesn't seem to me that this new American mandate is cracking that open at all. We still see the ghost of its past incarnation.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not only the legacy of empire, which you have in the Mukherjee and the Flanagan, but it's also cataclysmic points in both a nation or nation's history and turning points. And I think Jonathan obviously said that each book on the shortlist is very different, but actually I think there are some similarities between the Mukherjee and the Flanagan in terms of both what we've talked about as a conventional Booker winner and with the structure and with the theme.
A.S. Byatt made a really good point in her review of The Lives of Others, saying, she said, the novel is an agnostic form. It can juxtapose incompatible ideas, beliefs and human beings, showing us impossibilities and disorder with the wonderful order of adequate language and vision. That's a sort of very neat summary of what actually these books do.
So with that in mind, let's hear from Neil Mukherjee, reading from The Lives of Others.
When you look at a field full of ripened grain, ready to be harvested, it's a uniform brown gold sand colour. But as you cut with your sickle, you notice that there's still some green inside, hiding within the larger brown, a few long, partially green leaves, a little green fraction of a stalk. And as you cut these down, a tiny cloud of insects hiding in their massed density flies out. Some wriggle away into the thickets not yet harvested. Some scurry into the grass and sheaves and earth around you. And yet another thing, the sound of the paddy plants as you enter the thicket and cut them down. That rustle and rattle, louder, much louder now, accompanied by something between the snap of an almost dry stalk and the wet snip of cutting through a twig that's still partly green. I can't explain very well. Taken together, this swishing of dry, dense vegetation fills your ears. You can hear it at night, resounding in your head before you slip into the total silence of sleep. My hands were sore in the morning after a night's sleep. I couldn't make a fist, so I made myself make a fist 10, 15, 20 times with each hand. The cracks reopened and beaded with blood.
Some were tiny red threads, the red smudging when I touched them. And speaking of sleep, I'd never known sleep like this before, a total wiping out of all senses, all consciousness. I hadn't known exhaustion like this before either, a bone-breaking, bone-aching tiredness. That little revelation again, granted to an outsider, of the hidden inner cogs and wheels of the lives of others. Now I knew yet another reason why everyone in the heart of rural Bengal went to sleep so early.
Thanks to Catherine Taylor and Jonathan Rupin. Next week's podcast turned politics, with Roger Scruton's recipe for conservatism in our turbo-capitalist world and Andrew Marr's first novel, Head of State, while Guardian Weekly investigates how authors navigate the transition from page to screen. You can find more books podcasts on SoundCloud, iTunes, or on the Guardian website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast. From me, Richard Lee, Claire Armitstead, and our producer, Tim Mabey, thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code Guardian to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.